The Milwaukee Journal Sentinel Milwaukee Brewers podcast. I know it's snowing outside, but we still have a little bit of baseball to talk about. Maybe that's even a nice tonic for what's going on in the weather in Wisconsin here in early November. My name is J.R. Radcliffe, host of the Journal Sentinel Brewers podcast, and I'm joined on the other line by Brewers beat reporter Tom Haudricourt. We have some news to discuss. Early in the week, the Brewers announced that they were not going to pick up the option for first baseman Eric Thames. They also traded pitcher Chase Anderson to the Toronto Blue Jays for a minor league first baseman named Chad Spanberger. And kind of some surprising moves, Tom. I don't think anybody was quite prepared for the Brewers to essentially decline both of those options. We'll start with Chase Anderson. Starting pitching is hard to find. He was, I wouldn't say inexpensive, but he's certainly about what you'd expect to pay for somebody of Anderson's caliber with the option that was available there. Did that catch you off guard as well, that the Brewers decided to move him to Toronto?
Yeah, I think I tweeted that morning that today's the day that the Brewers need to declare themselves on the options of Chase Anderson, Eric Thames, and Manny Pena. I think I put in the tweet something like, I expect them to exercise all three options, because I did not think they were ready to cut those guys loose. And also, I didn't think in today's market that the money was that high. And so then they ended up trading Anderson and declining Thames. And I saw someone tweeted back at me later, Tom, with the pulse on the Brewers, as always, you know. So, but it just shows you how surprising that this management group can be at times. And perhaps we should stop being surprised when they do stuff, because, I don't think anybody saw the Thames signing 3 years ago coming, out of Korea. That was way out of the box. So, this tells you a few things. The fact that they were willing to cut ties with Chase Anderson and trade him shows that they know they have to go out and get some more arms, because right now they don't even have enough starting pitchers to fill a rotation, unless you're going to go back to Peralta and Burns, who didn't work out last year in a big way, particularly Burns. So, they don't – right now you could sort of say you got Adrian Houser, Brandon Woodruff, and Zach Davies, but it thins out in a big way after those three guys. Unless you're going to say Brent Suter is going to be a starting pitcher again, and he was way better in relief last year. So, and when that subject was broached with David Stearns on a conference call later in the day, JR, he said, we know we have to go out this winter and assure that we have innings covered. Right now they do not have innings covered. So they're going to have to go out and get some arms, and maybe two or three of them, whether they're, the big moves that people always hope the Brewers will make, like top of the market moves. I think we can pretty much assure that won't happen. But maybe they'll figure out a way to bring back Jordan Lyles, who they really liked and did a good job for them. But they're more apt to trade for pitching or make secondary tier pitching moves than they are. I mean, they're not going to sign Garrett Cole or Steven Strasburg. That just doesn't fit into their budget at all. And the other thing that it showed us, JR, by making those moves was merely clearing $15 million, which they did by not exercising Thames and Anderson, gives them some leeway for something they've obviously got planned down the road. It may just be covering the raises of their own players. They have they still have 11 guys left in arbitration. You're going to have a huge hit on Josh Hader, who qualified for Super 2 status exactly on the day. Well, 2 years and 115 days. He fell right in on the bottom margin, but that's going to give him a huge raise. I mean, I would love to present Josh Hader's case to an arbitration panel, wouldn't you?
Yeah, that's going to be a tough conversation for the Brewers. But what that actually tells me is, because the way they determine that cutoff is by having a certain percentage of guys who've had 2+ years in the big leagues, they line them up and they just sort of cut it off at the right percentage mark. And so Josh Hader was the last guy in.
Right.
And if there had been one other guy who'd come into the big leagues a day sooner, it could save the Brewers a couple million. So that was essentially some bad luck, I would imagine, for the Brewers.
Not for Josh Hader.
No, he's very happy with that, I'm sure. But we know he's been underpaid, so.
Yes, and he made them renew his contract last year rather than, you know, they assign they have a formula that they use for pre-arbitration players where you basically qualify for a certain salary. He did not like the number they presented him, so he just made them renew him. He said, "I'm just that's the only protest he can have is to not accept it, make them renew him," and he did. So, for those who aren't familiar with Super 2 status, top 22% each year of players between 2 and 3 years of service time also are given arbitration. And what you end up with is 4 years of arbitration instead of three before you become a free agent. And it shows us that they didn't have that many players between 2 and 3 years of service time at the top of the scale this year, because this is the lowest I've ever seen it go down to the top 22%, 115 days. Usually it's in like the 130 day to 140 days, like the lowest it goes. So as you said, unlucky for the Brewers, but lucky for Josh Hader. So, they cleared $15 million off the books by not exercising the options on Anderson and Thames, but they also blew a couple of holes in their roster too.
Yeah, I think that's what surprises me so much about the Anderson situation, because you, like you said, they're very unlikely to go after Strasburg or Gerrit Cole. Their MO has been not to go after any top line starting pitchers.
Right.
It's very easy to remember a couple of years ago when they brought in Yoli Chacin, and everybody thought that they would go after one of the other sort of big four names that were out right there at the time. It was a great move. It worked out, but they're not going to go out there and sign the top flight. I would argue they probably wouldn't even be in on a guy like Zach Wheeler, although I could be wrong there. Do you have any sense that their MO has shifted at all, that they are going to invest in starting pitching? That would be the first time we've seen that from David Stearns.
Well, not at that level. And it would be the first time. I mean, every year when I joust on Twitter with people over the pitching market, they say, because we've heard the Yu Darvish rumors in the past, the Jake Arrieta rumors in the past, and they always turn out to be false. So I always tell people, well, when David Stearns makes his first top of the market pitching move, then you can start giving me grief about me saying he's not going to do it. But as you just noted, he has not done it yet. They seem to be way more interested in building offense than they are building pitching, and that they think they can just make do with the pitching that they have. I do think they have a budding star in Brandon Woodruff. But, J.R., we've talked about this many times. Teams in the Brewers' market size have to develop their own starting pitching. And that's why last year they took the gamble on Peralta, Burns, and Woodruff, because they were going to go with three of their own guys. And it just, they went one for three. Woodruff made it. It does look like Freddy Peralta is a new age multi-inning reliever, the kind of guys that they like. And so that seems to be where he excels. But they have to constantly try that and push that envelope. And, some of their top prospects now are pitchers, so there are some coming in the pipeline. They drafted a ton of pitching last year, especially a ton of left-handed pitching. But I think guys like Ethan Small and Zach Brown, can be in their future in the next few years. And then we'll see about the other guys. But they're going to have to develop their own pitching. And their philosophy is to bang with teams with home runs, which makes it a little surprising they got rid of Eric Thames, because he certainly fit that mode.
Right, and let's talk more then about Eric Thames. He was on a pretty inexpensive deal, signed out of Korea. Unquestionably, the Brewers got maximum value out of that 3-year deal, but it seemed likely they would pick up his option rather than buy him out and have at least the left-handed portion of a platoon at first base. He still would be getting paid, I would say, a fair amount to do what he did if he was able to replicate what he did in 2019 when he had a very, very productive season. It's easy to have seen, Ryan Braun being the right-handed portion of that if he moves to first base, Eric Thames left-handed. I'm sure they're not crazy about Ryan Braun at first base, so I don't know if that was ever in the cards. But the left-handed portion being gone now, unless they sign him back on a smaller deal, I don't know if you think that's remotely possible that he could come back on a lesser amount of money, or if they just look at that first base market like it always is. It's pretty easy to find guys who can mash but are limited defensively and can only play first base. Right. Maybe they just figure they can find Eric Thames for a cheaper rate somewhere else.
Yeah, it'd be interesting to see if they do, or if they do it via trade or something like that. Yeah, I mean, it didn't seem like $7.5 million was a lot to pay for a guy that has 20 to 30 home run potential. And not just potential, he's done it. You know, he does it. He goes out there and does it. And so I remember the sensation he was when he first came to Milwaukee. He hit like 11 or 15 home runs in the first month of the season that year. And yeah. So, you know, I go back. Baseball's so volatile as far as rosters, and particularly with players who haven't established themselves over many years. Last year, they started the season. Basically, Jesus Aguilar was going to see most of the time at first base, and Thames was going to, you know, see secondary time at first base. And then Aguilar fell into that deep, deep slump and never really emerged. Eventually got and, you know, we still have to wait till December 2nd to see if they're even going to tender a contract to Travis Shaw. You know, he had they have to be very nervous about him after what he did or didn't do last season. And so who knows? But, you know, they don't just make these moves willy-nilly without, you know, having some plan for replacement. So only they know what that plan is. There are a bunch of free agent first basemen out there, but they're almost all in their 30s. You know, basically the way they evaluate players now is not real kind to guys who are in their 30s.
No, for sure. You're talking about year to year, how volatile it is. I think if they had released Eric Thames or traded him or whatever last offseason, nobody would have batted an eye. I think everyone sort of thought that's where it was headed because he had struggled with injuries in 2018, hadn't made the postseason roster. And now here we are a year later, in disbelief that they didn't pick up the option for yet a fourth year. So things do change pretty dramatically. You also mentioned that there's a lot of raises to be had here. There's a lot of certainly if they want to retain someone like Mike Moustakas or Yasmani Grandal, they're going to have to shell out a ton of cash. Do you get the sense payroll-wise, the Brewers are going to go up in payroll, right? This isn't some sort of precursor to just simply being more fiscally responsible in 2020. Is it they're definitely going to keep moving forward with the payroll, you would think, right?
Well, I don't know about moving forward, but I think they'll at least keep it in the general area where it was. You know, last year they opened right around $125 million. That was their all-time high, actually by quite a bit. And so I would think they would at least stay in that area. They might push it forward a little bit, but I don't think it's going to be pushed forward a ton. You know, right now they have some pretty good flexibility. They only have four players signed for next year. Three of them do have fairly big contracts, Braun, Kane, and Yelich, but not monster contracts, you know, like some of the teams have with some of their best players. And then Manny Pena, who they, you know, exercised a very small option on $1.85 million to sort of remain their backup catcher. So they're like, with those four players, they've committed like $46 million. So even under the previous payroll, the $125 million, they're looking at like $80 million they still have to spend. Of course, a lot of that will get sucked up with their own arbitration guys. But they obviously have some flexibility. I mean, right now, you know, they have holes at first base, third base, and catcher. Those are all very important offensive positions. And you're not going to find a better offensive catcher than Grandal on the market. You know, so either they're going to go backwards on offense at that position or, you know, pony up the money to bring him back. And who knows what the markets are for those two guys. You know, the free agent market's been depressed the last few years, and certainly for 30-somethings, it has not been what it used to be. Both those guys are 31. And so let's see what they get offered. You know, one thing you have to say about those guys, they went out and did what they had to do to make themselves attractive on the marketplace. You know, Grandal had, you know, the best offensive season of any catcher in the major leagues across the board. And then also contributed defensively. And Moustakas was the bopper that they wanted him to be, and a willing participant at second base until it was time to move back to third base. So those guys remain great fits on the team, but they're probably really good fits on other teams too.
It's just so fascinating to think of what the Brewers have ahead of them. Those openings that you mentioned, the offense that they need to add, they're not, I would have to think, they're not going to be, you know, they need to be aggressive with Christian Yelich. He's only here a few more years, you know, but on the current contract, you've got to think they're going to try to maximize their chances with him. And yet you don't see a lot of options on the free agent market that you think are in their price range and can dramatically help them. They don't have obvious trade candidates. The farm system doesn't have guys that are just, you know, that you think that the team is going to be able to get a big return for. This feels like an unsolvable puzzle, honestly, this offseason for David Stearns. And I imagine we're going to get some we're going to hear some early things, I got to think, but because there's a lot to do to get done this offseason.
Yeah, it's. I don't think it's unsolvable. I just think it's hard to solve.
Yeah, for sure.
And so you can make a case that this is the most important offseason since Stearns became general manager after the 15 season. And here's why. The first 2 years, he was in strict teardown mode. And so you just keep selling, and rebuilding. But then after they got Yelich and Lorenzo Cain on the same day prior to the 18 season, everything changed, and they went into go-for-it mode. And then they went, you know, they continued go for it mode by getting Grandal and Moustakas last spring. So, you know, the thing you mentioned about Yelich, they probably feel about Christian Yelich the way the Packers feel about Aaron Rodgers and the Bucks feel about Giannis Antetokounmpo. And that you got to win while you got them, right? While you have, you know, one of the top 3 to 5 players in your sport, you've got to win while you have them, right? So
right.
They probably so there's some pressure to win while they still have Yelich, and Yelich in his prime too. So I just think it's a very important winner, and they, you know, teams like the Brewers don't have margin for error like teams like the Dodgers and the Yankees and the Red Sox have. They can't eat a huge contract mistake. So they have to, like, hit on their moves.
Elsewhere, outside of the hot stove, the Brewers did get some good news when Rawlings unveiled its gold gloves. Lorenzo Cain, finally, the center fielder, the standout center fielder, has that hardware he'd been looking for. He has been one of the best defensive center fielders in baseball for years, but had never received a gold glove. 2018, a massive snub. And quite honestly, in 2019, if you look at the guys he was competing with, Harrison Bader and Victor Robles, all three of them great defenders. Statistically, yep. Robles might have had an edge, but he's a rookie player who hasn't, you know, paid the dues that Lorenzo Cain has. And so it felt like maybe this was a little bit of a market correction for 2018. You got to talk to Lorenzo after this. I got to think he was relieved that this is finally on his mantle where it belongs.
Yeah, I think relief maybe more so than elation, although lots of elation too. I mean, it won't surprise me if he tries to wear the gold glove out to the outfield next year, just like put it on his hand and try to play with it. I don't recommend that. That's a good way to make a lot of errors. But, I mean, this just means a lot to him. You know, he said to me, that he had sort of given up after last year. Like you said, we all thought he was going to win it last year, and Ender Inciarte from Atlanta won it instead. But so he had sort of just said, I'm not going to win it. And then that's when he won it. That's how funny life can be. But he also told me that, you know, if I never win another one, I at least got one. And I think it just means something to him to have one. You know, it's like the great actor that gets nominated 10 times for the Oscar and then finally wins it in the 10th time. At least you finally got one, you know.
You're always an Oscar winner. He will always be a Gold Glove winner.
Exactly. He's always going to be a Gold Glove winner now. And so, you know, I don't think he got extra credit for stealing 5 home runs, but it didn't hurt. You know, they use the process is votes by managers and coaches count for 75% of the process, and then 25% is the Sabre defensive index. And I looked at that Sabre, and Cain was ahead of both Robles and Bader in their defensive index. Only they know, you know, how they formulate that number. But he was ahead of those guys. And then, That leaves it up to managers and coaches. And I think the Brewers did a really good job, and Kane's teammates and counsel, his manager in particular, of letting it be known that this guy had been snubbed long enough. I mean, Gio Gonzalez was very emphatic in that final series in Colorado. Remember that catch he made on Saturday night to rob the two-run homer, and the Brewers went on and lost in extra innings, unfortunately. And he got hurt. Kane got hurt too in a play at the plate. But Gio Gonzalez said, "Give him his damn gold glove, would you?" I mean, after the game, he was very, very emphatic that enough is enough, and it's time to reward one of the best players at his position. So, he robbed a home run to save the opening day game. So his candidacy got off to a really good start. And
Yeah, that's
so,
one of the biggest moments in Wisconsin sports this year, that opening day save.
I mean, it's incredible. I mean, opening day, and you save the game by stealing a homer? I mean, come on. How much better can a game get to begin a season? And then he almost bookended it by, stealing one at the very end, too. Good for him. It's not like the Brewers have a ton of Gold Glove winners in their history. They went a long time without a Gold Glove winner until Carlos Gomez won one a few years back. And so, we've been blessed with really to watch really tremendous center field defensive play for the Brewers for the last many years, because Carlos Gomez was as good as it got out there. And then, Keon Broxton served as the, bridge to Kane, and Keon was really good at stealing home runs. And so we've seen, some great defensive play out there. And not just stealing home runs, just the way Lowe can just make catches you don't think he's going to make. I tell him he's got some Muhammad Ali in him. He's got some rope-a-dope in him, because he looks like he's not going to get to a ball, then all of a sudden he does get to it. So he does have a way of kicking it into another gear. And we should never forget how banged up he was during that season. He had a really bad thumb issue that he ended up having to get injected, like Ryan Braun has had to do. Then his left leg was a mess by season's end. He had hurt his knee and his ankle. And so he's out there playing on one leg, and he was still stealing home runs. So he certainly is a gamer. And, he's everything right about baseball. He's a good person and a good player and a team leader. And he led by going out and playing hurt last year. And so it's nice to see him get rewarded.
Yeah, great shout out to Keon Broxton, who took away a home run around the 4th of July in 2018 against the Twins. That was, I want to say, the second out of the ninth. The next guy homered, and it ended up being a one-run win for the Brewers, so it ended up saving the game. And you're right, the center field play has been very flashy, and you wonder if Lorenzo Cain's ability to sort of just make the difficult look routine has worked against him, because he does, he takes such great routes that that maybe people don't realize how great he is. But he has the flash. He steals, like you said, five home runs stolen this year, so he was very deserving. And he's not the only Brewers Award winner here, because at the very least, we know that Christian Yelich will finish top three in the NL MVP voting, and Craig Counsell will finish top three in the Manager of the Year voting. That gets unveiled next week. Tuesday will be the Manager of the Year reveal, Thursday for MVP. I think we all assume at this point, and have assumed for most of the season, that Cody Bellinger is the favorite there for the Dodgers for the MVP, especially with Yelich getting hurt at the end of the season, that that Bellinger would probably be the pick for that award. Maybe, maybe not. Maybe Christian Yelich sneaks in there. But the Manager of the Year is very interesting to me, because I don't think we thought about Counsell as a serious candidate until this late season surge in September. He's going up against Brian Snitker of Atlanta, who won it last year. Maybe he doesn't have quite the same narrative as last year. And the Cardinals manager, Mike Schilt, who I would imagine has a little bit of an edge there, but I don't know. I think Counsell could win this thing. What is your sense on the sweepstakes here?
Well, Schilt is going to win it if it goes the way it's gone for the last several years. Unfortunately, if you take a close look at the balloting and the manager of the year, it's become more the team that advanced the most wins from the previous year award. That's what Brian Snitker did last year, and it's what we've seen a lot of managers get the award, because they just won way more games. Their teams won way more games than they had the year before. So therefore, it's assumed they did a great managerial job. You could have made a case that Council had to manage way harder than Brian Snitker last year, certainly in September, because the Braves were way ahead in their division and had it in cruise control, and the Brewers were five games back on Labor Day, and Council had to manage his butt off to get them there. And so he sort of did the same thing again this year. You know, they were, once again, it looked like they were hopelessly out of it on September 6th after they lost the opener of that four-game series to the Cubs. They were 7.5 out of first and 5 out of the wild card. The second wild card just didn't look doable. And daggone if they didn't do it again, have a tremendous September surge, and losing Yelich along the way. Maybe if Yelich's injury is going to cost him the MVP award, maybe it's going to give Council the Manager of the Year award because he kept the team going without Yelich. And so we'll see what the voters valued more. The Cardinals moving so far ahead of their win total the year before, or what Council had to do in what looked like a hopeless situation in September. You know, it's amazing that Davey Martinez is not even in the mix.
Or Dave Roberts.
I know. But Davey Martinez, even more, they were 19-31, JR.
Yeah, for sure. You're totally right.
The votes go in at the end of the regular season, so their postseason surge doesn't count at all. But they went 19-31. When the Brewers swept them here in May last year, they were saying Martinez might get fired the next day. And he did not. And then, you know, I think that was one of the biggest recoveries ever to make the postseason. So at least we have lots of great candidates. You know, the Cardinals were 500 at the break last year and then finished way, way, way over 500 the rest of the way and won the division. So there are many, all of these guys are deserving. But, you know, we'll see if Council. I love the quote from Tom Verducci on the MLB Network broadcast the other day when they were announcing the finalists, and they noted that for the second straight September, Council worked magic with the expanded rosters. And Verducci's quote was great. He said, "Giving Craig Council extra players is like giving Jackson Pollock extra paint."
Yes, I saw on Twitter some people are not as familiar with the abstract expressionist American artists as you are.
I don't know what to be more upset about, the fact that you don't know American art history or that you don't know how to Google.
Yeah, at this point, what's the difference? If you know how to Google, you should know everything, right? You just have to Google it. So who cares? Oh, that's funny. But yeah, I do think Shildt will win it, if only because you say, well, who did better, the Cardinals or the Brewers? And, you know, in the same division, I think Shildt will get the nod that way. But fascinating, like you said, Dave Martinez went from being almost fired, and now that he's won the World Series, you got to give him at least, like, what, another 3 years, even if everything goes wrong. I mean, he won a World Series for the city of Washington. That's not something that's going to be just forgotten about in a quick, you know, in quick order.
No, just like Lorenzo Cain's Gold Glove, Davey Martinez will always have a World Series ring.
It's true. It's true. One more off the field thing that's come up. It does sound there's some pretty credible sort of speculation rumors out there that the Brewers are going to be going back to their ball and glove logo on a more permanent basis. We've seen it over the course of the last several years, really since 2006, they've had it at least as an alternate in some capacity. I think they wore it for 50 some games, 52 games maybe this year. So it's a pretty regular visitor to the Brewers wardrobe. But to do it on a more permanent basis would be going back to the logo that was in place from 1978 to I believe 1992. I know the Brewers have said nothing about it. They've declined to really comment on it, so there's nothing official yet. But I do think that would be pretty interesting, and I think a lot of Brewers fans would be pretty excited. I know, I mean, you covered some teams that wore that logo. You kind of know what that logo means to the city of Milwaukee and Brewers fans in general.
Yeah, and you know, it's all tied to their upcoming 50th anniversary year, 2020. You know, they came to Milwaukee in 1970. They've this was their 50th season, if you do the math, but next year's the 50th anniversary, you know, when you just go anniversaries versus actual seasons played. So, and the Brewers are, you know, Tyler Barnes responded to the story that you did about the rumors of the ball and glove logo, that they do have changes coming for the 50th anniversary that they think their fans will be excited about. So he didn't give anything away. He didn't confirm anything, but he did say they have changes coming. So this falls under the category of where there's smoke, there's fire, you know? And so, And they did shut down their team store for quote unquote remodeling.
Suspicious, Tom. It's suspicious.
I think the remodeling means hanging new gear on the hangers.
Yes.
So, and you know, they said that they would reopen on November 18th, I believe was the date that they gave. So, you know, I think very soon this mystery, which isn't really much of a mystery anymore, will be unveiled. But you know, just anecdotally, and you go out to Miller Park a lot, I would just guesstimate 75% of the apparel that's worn out there is the ball and glove logo. Don't you agree? If I mean, I may even be light there,
Yeah, I don't know if it's quite that. There are a lot of New Jerseys too, but like at least more than half of people are wearing something that has that ball and glove logo somewhere on them.
Right. And the Brewers have, you know, used their retro jerseys. You know, a lot of people think that retro jersey that they've worn at home on the last few years of the Friday nights with the pinstripes and the ball and glove logo is the greatest uniform the team's ever had. And, you know, it makes you wonder if that's something that they're going to try to reimagine with the 50th anniversary uniform. So, but, you know, I do think that a lot of people think it was the greatest branding mistake the team ever made was to go away from that logo. That interlocking M and B that they went to didn't last very long. Drew Olsen and I, when we were covering the beat, we used to call it Motrabame because it looked like the interlocking N and D of Notre Dame. So we called it Motrabame. But they've gone through a few reiterations now, and I think there was a real desire, and understandably so, to carve their own identity going forward too. But there's lots of teams that have had that have stuck with way worse logos than the Brewers ball and glove logo that they abandoned. And it's a fascinating story, you know, the college kid that won the contest, and then and shockingly, there are still people that have to be told that's an M and a B forming that glove.
I think that's the best part of that logo is you still to this day have, and you get younger fans who didn't grow up with it too, but it still dawns on people. Tom, I think of myself as somebody who grew up with the Brewers, followed them very closely. I got to college, had a hat with the M and B glove logo. I was in college and somebody pointed it out to me. So even somebody who followed it closely didn't really have a handle on it. I just thought it was a ball and glove, whatever. It's just their thing.
And it just shows how ingenious the design was, right? When you don't
Incredible.
really, when you just look at it as a ball and glove, then all of a sudden the eureka moment of, wait a minute, it's an M and a B.
I'm really excited. I'm digging in a little bit on the history of it, and Tom Mindell, the artist, is unfortunately he passed away in 2018. But I've talked to a couple of his family members and a couple other people associated with the organization to try to get a little bit of backstory on that logo, and it's something that could never happen again because teams aren't going to hold a contest for that where college kids can enter with ideas or anybody can enter with their ideas. They're going to go to a private firm, have it made for them. There's too many like royalties and issues at hand. This is this type of story that honestly cannot happen today. That's part of why it makes it so great.
Yeah, it is. And so, if all the indications turn out to be true that that's what's happening, I think it's going to be wildly successful, don't you? I don't think there's going to be any outcry. I think there's going to be a whole lot of love if that's what they end up doing, don't you?
Yeah, I definitely agree with you. Yes. So before we get out of here, one last thought. Since we last talked, Carlos Subero, the first base coach, was relieved. The Brewers looking for what looks like a new voice there. Any sense on what they're looking for? If they just felt like they needed a new face, a new voice, or is there something a little bit more complex about what they're trying to do with the first base position?
No, I think I just think they thought they did want a new voice. You know, they have had some issues with their infield defense, and they've got to get Keston Hira playing way better at second than he did last year, and I think he will. And then Orlando Arcia kind of has had his ups and downs at short too. So I do think they just kind of are looking for a new direction. You know, Severo did serve many different roles because he also was, you know, their only Hispanic coach, and they had a lot of Hispanic players on the team. So it's something, it'll be interesting to see if they go from outside the organization or promote somebody from within. But they've still had a very stable coaching staff here for several years. Basically, since Council's been the manager, it's been this same group until last year when they finally did lose a couple of their top coaches, Darnell Coles and Derek Johnson. But they obviously are like what they saw from Andy Haynes and Chris Hook, because they are coming back. I do think, and we heard the outcries of, hey, they're not doing as good in both categories as they should have been. I do think there's a danger in constantly turning your staff over that you don't get any continuity whatsoever. So they've got the one, change. Sounds like Pat Murphy was interviewed a couple of times for that Mets managerial job that eventually went to Carlos Beltran. So it looks right now that he'll be back as Council's right-hand man. So, yeah, I think we'll hear something on that soon. I tweeted the other day that Council's coming up on the last year of his contract, too. I see no way we get to opening day with that still being the case. They're bound to have an extension announcement sometime between now and then. So I there's absolutely no reason to let him get to the last year of his contract. Yeah. I mean, when the Cubs did that with Joe Maddon last year, I think everybody knew what was going to happen, and it happened.
Yeah, two-time finisher here in the top three of the Manager of the Year voting. That's not somebody that they're just going to let ride out to the last year of his deal. I don't know if we'll ever know truly what coaches do. I mean, we know what their job titles are, what their roles are, but I don't know if we'll ever actually have data, forward-facing data, that tells us whether a coach is doing well or not. It's so much behind-the-scenes stuff. You just have no way of knowing if a hitting coach is making an impact, if the infield coach is making an impact. It's a very weird process. So it always is interesting to me which guys get released. It seems like there's no way that the public would really know what the methodology is there. It might just be how they interact with people on the team. It's kind of a weird science.
Yeah, I think they're part psychiatrists. It's just the pat on the back that the guy's looking for when he's struggling sometimes. And then if they actually find mechanical things that'll help a player be better. But they're part father. You're kind of like the daddy of some of those young players. Part father, part psychiatrist, and part coach. And so it's very complicated. I do think they're probably the most underpaid people in the sport. And everybody agrees that the manager and the coaches get way too much credit when the team does well and way too much blame when the team does bad. And so, but you do want a good coaching staff. And, I think just getting back to Council, I think that, just the fact that he keeps finishing in the top three and this balloting for manager year shows you where he is considered in the sport now. And how about this? And we can end it on this little factoid that's kind of amazing, JR. So Craig Council was named manager 1 month into the 2015 season, right? That's not that long ago, right?
He's an elder statesman now.
He's the senior manager in the National League now in tenure with his team.
That is just wild.
And I can't wait to point that out to him. I'm just going to start calling him old man,
Yeah. Hey. But, he doesn't look anything like an old man, even through the pains and tribulations of four baseball seasons. He looks pretty good for a guy who is the oldest, longest tenured manager in the National League at this point.
Yeah, unfortunately for me, I continue to look older and older, and he continues to look the same. He's frozen in time.
Yeah, and we're frozen out here in Milwaukee, Wisconsin, but at least there's a little baseball to talk about.
Yeah, he's frozen in time. We're just frozen.
It's true. He lives here, so he's frozen too. But exactly. But yes, he is Tom Hodricourt, Milwaukee Brewers beat reporter for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. We will catch up with you again, Tom, as news breaks. There's bound to be some hot stove action as the winter progresses. Thanks for joining us. We will chat again very soon.
Thanks, JR.
Find us on Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, or Spotify. You can find me on Twitter. I'm at JR Radcliffe. That's JRRADCLIFFE. Find Tom Hodricourt on Twitter. He's at Hodricourt. And let us know what you think. Thanks for tuning in this week. We'll catch you again soon.